scheduled maintenance, and repair service, including a nationwide warranty by ASE-certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we're pleased to welcome back Larry Keller, the owner of Wild Birds Incorporated in Champaign. He has been with us before a couple times to talk about birds, to answer some basic questions, to talk a little bit about bird watching, to talk about bird feeding. In his business, they sell bird feed and they sell feeders and they sell bird houses and all those kinds of things that people do to put up to try to attract birds to their yard so they can watch them and feed them. So we can have questions on that. We'll talk a little bit about some of the birds that are around right at the moment. We're coming into the fall migration season where there will be birds passing through here. So you'll have the opportunity to see some that you might not see the rest of the time, that you maybe you only see in the spring and the fall when they pass through. And general bird questions, bird watching, bird feeding questions are all welcome, and I know that he'll do his best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning.
You know, one of the things that I had thought about asking was, I was curious about how, over the last few years, bird populations have been affected by West Nile. Because certainly there was a time when it seemed that we had actually seen a reduction in the numbers of some birds that sadly enough had been killed by West Nile. And I'm not sure that they have quite rebounded. And I guess I was just wondering if you could talk in general terms about that.
Well, the biggest thing that the general public is aware of course, was the crows and the blue jays.
Right. Yeah.
They were very susceptible to West Nile because it caused a death, and so the recovery of the bodies was very easy to determine, you know, where the West Nile was located at in a given population. The West Nile is just about in every bird population there is, no matter what species it is. Probably your single biggest carrier of West Nile is house sparrow, and the simple reason is there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at different populations of birds, what has been affected? Obviously, the crows and blue jays have been affected. Certain areas where the black-capped chickadees are at, they've been affected greatly. Another one that people don't really pay attention to a lot, but the great horned owls, they seem like they were hit very hard by the West Nile. So certain bird populations were affected, others were not. So it really didn't bother certain populations. Now, as the disease gets into an environment, it seems like once it's there and it's been there for a while, the populations tend to get an immunity to it. The birds that are susceptible have died, so you no longer have them in the population and breeding. And there could be a possibility, I don't know if it's exactly proven, but once they have the disease, it's passed on from generation to generation, that death susceptibility is a lot less mm-hmm. for that particular species.
I guess the blue jay was one of the ones that I was thinking about, because certainly they're still around. Occasionally you do see them, but it seems that I have seen them much. You don't see them as much. Yeah, every once in a while you see them, and maybe sometimes more often you hear them because they have, you know, very characteristic sorts of calls that they make. So you can, once you hear one, you know what it is. But that I did feel like I just hadn't seen them in the numbers that in past years I'd remembered seeing.
Right, yeah, there's no question. Their population is down. It seems like in the last year and a half, it seems like the numbers are starting to come back. We've got more and more people that are saying they're seeing more, they're feeding more in the backyard. So I think once the disease, like I say, is in a given area and in a given environment, it's ran its course, and so now you're starting to see some rebound on that.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have a couple of callers here to talk with. Let's do that. We will start with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We've had a hummingbird feeder up that the hummingbirds were coming to. Usually just one at a time, even though there are multiple stations at the feeder because they guard it jealously. And yesterday we had the feeder down because we were washing the windows, and I didn't want to knock it, and I also wanted to refresh it and clean it. And I have on our balcony, not too far away from the first floor feeder, I have up on the second floor two window boxes with purple and red flowers in it that I thought the hummingbirds might like. And I hadn't noticed hummingbirds at those flowers until yesterday after I took the feeder down. And I was taking a nap in the bedroom, and I heard some squeaking, and I heard this really low, loud hum, and I looked, and sure enough, there was a hummingbird there. And I'm guessing that it was just easier to eat at the feeder, either that or I, for some reason, I hadn't noticed them at the flowers. And now I'm trying to decide whether to put the feeder back up or whether it's better to encourage them to feed from the flowers, or what do you suggest?
Well, there's a lot of research that's been done on bird feeding, and are we causing harm by bird feeding? Are we changing their migration patterns? Are we changing their feeding habits? And all the studies that have been done show that bird feeding, no matter what species it is, it's a secondary source of food. It's not their primary source. One of the biggest wives' tales that we hear during this time of year with concerning hummingbirds, once Labor Day hits, you got to take your hummingbird feeder down because they're going to stay here and they're going to freeze to death once it starts turning cooler at night, and they're not going to simply migrate to Mexico where they're supposed to. And there is absolutely no truth to that whatsoever. The instinct to migrate is the strongest instinct that a bird has besides propagating. And you're going to see that when the hummingbirds are coming through, especially during fall migration, we get a lot of them come through. Usually the males come through first, the adult males, then the adult females, and then all the juveniles are coming back through with the females and a little bit later. We've had people in this area up until December have hummingbirds at their feeders, and then finally they move on. So your feeder, your simple reason to have your hummingbird feeder in your yard, attract them to a location where you can sit there and observe them. They're not using it as a primary source. So having that feeder out, you're doing no harm whatsoever. They're still going to feed off the flowers, and a lot of people don't understand. They eat a ton of insects. They eat a lot of small flying insects. It's a very good source of protein for them, so they're constantly feeding on that also. And that's something that you'll never ever see or hardly ever see them doing.
I actually have seen them hunting insects once. I was out in the woods at a farm working on pulling garlic mustard, and there were no flowers around. And I kept hearing hummingbirds, and then I noticed I could actually see one, and it appeared just to be going after insects. So sometimes if you're out in a place and quiet, and you can actually see this stuff. One of my earlier interactions with hummingbirds, we were backpacking in the Glacier Peak Wilderness and fairly high up, and wearing orange backpacks.
Right.
And I would hear this humming sound periodically, and sometimes the hummingbirds would come find us. Sometimes they would sit out right in front of us, and then they would go,
"Eek!" Yeah,
very upset that we weren't a nice big patch of
exactly,
flowers.
Exactly.
I hadn't been aware that they had a call, and one of the things that told me that a hummingbird was outside on the balcony was it was making sort of a chirping sound.
Right. Yeah, they have a real high-pitched squeak or a chirp. A lot of times you hear it when they're chasing each other. And so when they're protecting that feeder and another hummingbird comes in, they'll give that little squeal and chase him out of there. And you'll hear them usually as it's fading away, as they're moving away.
How many feeders can they defend? I would think it might be worth putting up more than one feeder so that you could feed more than one hummingbird.
Right. You will get more hummingbirds in the yard because if you have more feeders. But the key is when you're standing at one feeder, you should not be able to see the other feeder. So they cannot defend them then. So a front yard, backyard, or a backyard, side yard, something along that line where he's sitting perched above the one feeder, he cannot see the other feeder.
Okay.
And therefore, they can't protect both of them. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
Thank
All
you.
Right, thank you. Let's go on to here, line number two. This is Color in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You mentioned house sparrows. I wonder if you can just comment to your listeners about the negative aspects of I guess just putting out some type of all-purpose seed, because I see sometimes flocks of, 10 to 40 house sparrows, and a lot of people are just sustaining large numbers of house sparrows. You mentioned the West Nile, but they also compete strongly with native cavity nesters.
Correct. House sparrows are, there's a direct link between them and the reduction in birds such as bluebirds, house wrens, even common woodpeckers that you would see like the downy woodpeckers. Anything that's a cavity nester is in great competition, not just with the European house sparrows, but also the European starlings.
Right.
Those two species are not native to North America. They were introduced species many, many decades ago, and centuries ago, actually. And because of that, it's a constant battle. There's no question. And a lot more people are becoming more and more aware of that problem. Food choice is definitely a situation that you need to look at when you're dealing with house sparrows. General mixes, very cheap mixes with a lot of corn base and a lot of millet base or milo base is going to attract a lot more house sparrows than, say, straight safflower or some of the larger sunflowers like the striped sunflower. So by your seed choice is definitely going to be very – you can be very species specific in the yard with the seed choice. Is somebody feeding bird seed in their backyard necessarily propagating the number of house sparrows in a given area? It's really hard to say. I don't know if I agree with that completely because house sparrows have proven that they can survive just about anywhere and everywhere. They're so prolific, they breed so often, and they nest just about anywhere also. Not necessarily just houses that you're putting up or cavities where birds would typically nest. But you can go to any building or office building or supply building, any place where there's an outdoor sign, you're going to see house sparrows nesting, anything like that.
Right. So you're just recommending more specific mixes because, I mean, the general mixes, I mean, from what I see, there's, you know, 98% of the visitors are house sparrows.
Correct.
And starlings.
Correct.
Combined.
And it's interesting, too, in our industry, house sparrows, the starlings, and the common grackles, those three are our biggest complaints at the feeder. Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of them? So most people who are really serious about the feeding and doing a lot of feeding, they understand what the problem is, they're aware of it, and they do try to correct it.
I guess my comment is just so you can comment to a lot of the naive people that are, you know, think that they're doing good. I would argue that they're not by sustaining maybe not grackles, but at least the starlings and the European sparrows.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Larry Keller, the owner of Wild Birds Incorporated in Champaign. And if you have bird questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, maybe you would want to talk a little bit more specifically about varieties of seed. I know you just go into the grocery store and you can buy big bags of seed and they are called different things, songbird mix and wild bird food and things like that. And I guess I'm not, you know, I have bought that to put in feeders around our house too. And I'm not exactly sure what it is that I'm getting. And if not that, then what kind of other feeds would you suggest?
The name on the bag really means nothing. Names are just used for selling the product. And so creative names usually aren't telling you what you're going to get inside the bag. Like anything else, when you're buying food for us, buying food for your pets, you want to look at the ingredients. A couple things to definitely stay away from is milo or sorghum and wheat. Those two particular seeds in this part of the country are the least consumed out of all the seeds. They're a very inexpensive seed on the commodity market, so that's why they're used in the bird seed mixes. And they do have a tendency to attract more of your so-called undesirables, such as the house sparrows. So you want to stay away from those type of seeds. You want to go with more seeds that are going to be attracting certain species that are native, for one, and also species that you definitely want to have in your yard, the sunflowers, the safflowers. Those two particular seeds, very high energy, extremely good for feeding in cold weather, also good for warm weather. Seeds such as a safflower seed is very nice because, like I mentioned, it does help keep the house sparrows down. You won't see as many house sparrows. And also keeps the grackles and starlings away, too. Cardinals love safflower seed, and so do the house finches. Mourning doves will pick up any seed, of course, that hits the ground. There's not a seed that a mourning dove doesn't like. Then you can get even more species-specific. There's a lot of different types of feeders on the market available for peanuts, either in the shell or out of the shell. So then you're starting to attract birds like Carolina wrens, the different woodpecker species, the blue jays. And then, of course, you've got the Niger thistle seed for the goldfinches and house finches, which will feed on that also. Mm-hmm. So if you're very careful, and a lot of times mixes are good. There are a lot of good mixes available. And we've got winter coming up, so we've got the juncos coming into the area. People call them common snowbirds. They like to eat the millets, the small grains at the ground level or on a platform feeder. So mixes that contain that during the wintertime are also very good. The second most consumed seed in this part of the country is the white millet or the proso white millet. It's very, very common in mixes, and just about every bird species will feed on it that are the small bird species, I should say.
Okay. Let's talk with some other callers here. We got some folks lined up. Aurora would be next. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, yes, good morning.
Good morning.
One of my favorite subjects, birds. I belong to Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, and I got this paper on winter bird feeding, and they gave an alternative to commercial mixes, and they are saying that the commercial mixes might have a high percentage of less appealing phylloseeds, such as red milo. And they say that you can create your own attractive, low-cost mixture yourself. And this is their recipe for it. And I made this, but I cut it in half. They're saying to pour one 25-pound bag of black oil sunflower seeds, one 10-pound bag of white Proso millet, and one 10-pound bag of cracked corn into a clean trash barrel and mix it up with a broomstick. And, of course, to replace the lid and cover it tightly. And I did do that, and, of course, I haven't had a lot of birds to see what exactly it would provide. What is your comment on this?
That mix is perfect. The only thing that I would recommend differently is that is really more of a cold weather mix, and I know that's what they said. Corn is used at the feeder by birds during the cold weather more than in the warm weather because they're using it to generate body heat. And so they're turning that over. So you will see if you use a mix such as that, you might have quite a bit of the corn left over in the tray or on the ground underneath the feeder. And what you can do is simply cut back the percentage of corn or eliminate the corn completely during the summertime.
What would you replace the corn with?
I would replace it with the sunflower seed.
Well, you have almost three-quarters of it is sunflower seeds. So you just put more sunflower seeds?
Right. About 97-98% of the birds that are going to feed at a bird feeder will eat the black oil sunflower seed. So by replacing that with more sunflower, you're doing no harm and you're still going to be attracting those species that you want to see.
And what can you do to keep English sparrows out? I heard you discussing it, but what was your final determination of that? What could you do?
The two best seeds to use to eliminate or really cut down the number of house sparrows is straight safflower seed, nothing else but safflower, or striped sunflower. Striped sunflower is a larger, thicker shell sunflower than the black oil sunflower, and it's a little harder for the small birds, such as the house sparrow, to shell. Now, there's an exception to every rule. And the biggest exception is once we get into cold weather, and extreme cold weather especially, you will see that the house sparrows, no matter what food you have out, it's a survival game, and they have to survive, and they're going to feed on just about anything and everything they can find. So if you have a scenario where we have a lot of snow cover, we have high winds and extremely bitter cold temperatures, it really does not matter what you put out. Those sparrows are still going to show up, and they're going to show up in mass to try to survive because they're losing so much body heat and losing so much body weight during those extreme temperatures. Times you're going to have those birds showing up. So if you stay with just a certain core seeds like the safflower or the striped sunflower, you're going to definitely eliminate the house sparrow activity at the feeder.
What if you put the white seed, I forget the name of
the
it,
white,
right?
White Proso millet?
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, what if you put the black oil sunflower seeds and the white Proso millet and then the other safflower seeds with that mix? Would that be a better thing to do?
It won't necessarily add any more deterrence to the house sparrows because the house sparrows are simply going to be feeding on that white proso and that black oil sunflower. They won't even touch the safflower seed that's in the mix. So you're still
right.
Going to have them there.
Thank you.
Okay,
right,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. One thing, we got a couple other calls here, but just because we had an earlier caller ask about hummingbirds, I thought I would ask you to talk a little bit about hummingbirds. Apparently, as we were talking here before we got going, this has been a huge time for hummingbird. You've seen apparently hummingbirds in greater numbers for some reason this year than before?
This year, probably more so in the last 10, 12 years, we've seen more hummingbirds on the fall migration. Two things. One, it seems like the fall migration started earlier. People were picking up the first week of August when we usually start to see mass numbers starting to show up in the first week of September. Also, the numbers seem to be a lot higher as far as the immature birds that we're seeing. So that's telling us that nesting success was very, very high, it seems like, this year. We still haven't even hit the peak migration time for hummingbirds to come through. Usually it's about the second, third week of September is when we really see a lot of them coming through. So I think if you're interested in hummingbirds, you put a hummingbird feeder out, you're going to see them this year. There's no question. They're just everywhere.
It's funny because some years ago we got a hummingbird feeder as a gift and have never used it. I think we still have it someplace. What do you put? I know that essentially what you're putting in there is sugar water, but how do you craft the feed for them?
There's two ways as far as the nectar goes. You can buy commercial nectar that's just a powder. It's a dextrose-sucrose mixture, and you add that to warm water, dissolve it to the appropriate amount that's on the box and use that. Or you can boil sugar water at home. You want to boil the water, dissolve sugar in that, and it's one part water – one to four is the ratio on that. So you're
going to
use
water, one
exactly. Pressure. Yep, exactly. So you're going to just use straight sugar water, no food coloring. Your feeder should have enough red on it that's what's going to attract the hummingbird. The food coloring does absolutely nothing, and there's been some evidence that the food coloring can do some harm to hummingbirds. So stay away from that. The big key is you're using a sugar water, something that sugar is going to grow mold and bacteria. So you have to clean the feeder, replace the nectar every 3 to 4 days is what we recommend. If it's extremely hot in the 90s for a long period of time, I'd recommend every other day replacing it. You want to keep that stuff fresh because if you don't, you're actually doing more harm than good by having that feeder out there, and the hummingbirds are picking up the mold and bacteria on the bill area, which causes death.
Okay, so what you're doing there is you're just making a simple syrup by dissolving the sugar in the water.
Right.
And you just put that in
exactly.
The feeder.
Yep.
Okay, very good. Well, let's go back to the phones here. Next caller is in Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two things. One, I was wondering if you could recommend, say, a couple of CDs that have bird songs that, you know, that you consider good.
Okay. If you're wanting for identification, Peterson has several CDs out. There's a Birding by Ear CD. That's a very, very good CD. There's another CD out by Stokes, and that one covers...
Common spelling, S-T-O-K-E-S?
Correct.
Okay.
And there's an Eastern and Western. Of course, you're going to want the Eastern, and when we talk Eastern and Western and birding, it's east of the Rockies.
Yeah.
You get the Eastern one, and I believe that one covers almost 375 bird species. And what's nice about the CDs is it comes with a booklet. So if you look up the bird in the booklet, it's going to tell you what CD. It might be on CD 2, track number 14. You can go right to that sound. So it's very, very easy to use.
That's by Stokes.
Yes.
Yeah. I know, I've seen the Petersons in my area, but I've never seen the Stokes thing at all.
Yeah, the Stokes ones is very nice, I think.
Okay, now the next question is, the second thing was, I don't mind sparrows. In fact, I bought a rather large, thick, slick-paged paperback. I think it was put out by Purdue, but anyway, which identifies most of the species.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll keep you busy, assure you, to get them. Then, you know, first time we got into this, I expected, ungodly tropical bird and everything to show up, and that doesn't work at all. I had a grosbeak one time, must have been flying overhead on migration pattern, showed up once, and you know, that was the end of that. And, of course, you get the nice cardinals. But the sparrows are, you know, I often find that odd about people don't want sparrows, so I presume they want all the colorful birds. I found it's just too much effort, and that if one gets into the sort of their habits and how they react, it's fine. Even had a couple of woodpeckers at the thing, which really surprised me. I was wondering if you could say something about that.
The term
of woodpeckers being, you know.
Right, yeah. Woodpeckers are very easy to attract to the yard. There's mixes available that's a high nut content mix. You can use shelled peanuts and different types of feeders, and, of course, the suet cakes commercial or the beef tallow that you can buy at the butcher's shop. Then you can use those to attract the woodpeckers. Now, as far as sparrows go, typically 99% of the complaints that you're getting about sparrows are simply just the house sparrow species. It's not the chipping sparrows or the white crowns or white-throated.
Yeah.
When you use the term sparrow, of course, that covers a very wide spectrum.
I get all those.
Right, yeah. Those are native birds. People really do enjoy seeing them around. It's just that the house sparrow is the one that people have the biggest problem with.
And I found out the hard way that big outfits like Walmart in particular – And the smaller stores do not change their thistle seeds very often. And
right.
Dry out.
Right.
And you can try for weeks. And I found that that they, the one you look down the list, this will track such and such if you use thistle. Well, I find them, hung the thistle out and didn't do much of anything. They were over at the regular one, eating the millet, I guess, and
right,
that stuff like that. So I stopped buying thistle seed altogether. It must be have to be awful fresh to get their attention.
Thistle is an imported seed, so once it is picked over, say, for example, in India is one of the countries it comes from.
Yeah.
Once it's picked there, processed there, bagged, put on the ships, brought over to here, it sits outside of our ports for, it can be weeks, even months, before the USDA inspects it. Then it has to go to a processing plant where it is heat sterilized.
God.
So there is a long time frame there before that stuff ever hits a store or a warehouse.
Yeah.
The best places you can buy from or feed stores, birding stores, places that are getting shipments in every week of this stuff. And if they keep it fresh, then you're going to have no problem.
Don't have that here, but I found out I've still got a couple tubes, down in my basement. I'm just going to probably throw them away when things start up for the birds. So thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for calling. Right,
thank you. Let's continue. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, line number two, right here.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Well, that's my question, too, about Niger thistle, because I used to have a lot of finches at my little tube feeder, and now they don't come anymore, and I've had this bag of Niger thistle for a couple of years, and I was just going to ask if it gets old and stale and dries out, and they won't eat it.
Niger thistle, all the rules with storing and presenting the seed completely changes when you go to Niger thistle. The Niger thistle seed that you store at home, and it does not matter if you're storing it in a sealed container, the original container, any way you store it at home, I do not recommend storing it for more than 4 months period of time. So anything, and especially if you overwinter thistle, because our humidity level is so low, it dries the seed out immediately. There is an oil in the thistle. Thistle is sold on the commodities market in the palm oil industry. They use it for cooking oil, just like we use soybean oil here.
Oh, Niger thistle is used for to make palm oil?
Well, it's in the market as the same as palm oil. It's in the palm oil seeds is what we call it on the commodities exchanges.
Oh.
So the Niger thistle, it has a high oil content in each seed. However, if it dries out, there is absolutely no nutritional value for the bird, and they will drop that seed or won't even touch it altogether. So if you see you're feeding a lot of finches and underneath your feeder you have a lot of seed underneath the feeder, it's one of two things. Either you're getting a lot of shells accumulating underneath there, but more than likely there's a lot of dry seed in that batch.
Okay, well, I've had a bag for about 2 years.
That needs to be replaced.
Throw that away. Huh?
Right. And the other thing, too, that you want to keep in mind is when in your feeder, you do not want to keep thistle seed for more than 4 weeks out in the feeder.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's either going to dry out or it's going to gather so much moisture, you're going to start to have mold growth in there anyway.
Oh.
And when you're filling the feeder, don't put fresh seed on top of a half a tube of oil.
That's what I've been doing.
Right. That's the biggest problem. What you want to do is take the feeder, clean it, warm soapy water once a month on the inside and out, wash it off really good, let it dry completely overnight, then put fresh thistle in, and you'll be ready to go.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, thank you. That helps so much.
Great.
Okay,
thank you.
Very good. Thank you. On again to another caller. This is someone listening in Savoy, line number three. Hello.
Hello. I apologize. I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago and caught some discussion about a hummingbird.
Okay.
And I have some property in rural Monticello that I saw a hummingbird on in about July.
Okay.
And I actually purchased the property from somebody who said that hummingbirds were there quite frequently, and they've fed on the honeysuckle?
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. What in that area that you're describing is one of our best locations around here for hummingbirds because they do nest there. So typically mid-April is when they'll start to show up, and in certain areas where they're nesting, you'll have them stay around all summer. And then they'll stick around, and your numbers, of course, will increase during fall migration when the migration's coming back through in September. And typically I tell people around here, you can keep hummingbird feeders up till Halloween or so. When you go about a week, week and a half, and you've seen no more hummingbirds at the feeder, you're pretty well safe to take it down because they're gone.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
To Champaign. This is line number one for another caller. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I called some years back because I was looking at Crystal Lake Park and the Canada geese that are there.
Okay.
And there was some kind of a strange goose, and you helped me realize that it was just a regular gray goose from a farm. And I said, he's really hanging around the other geese. Will he interbreed? And you gave me the impression that he wouldn't, and they wouldn't accept him and so forth. But the very next year, he had a little gaggle of geese following behind him with a lady friend at the front. And I thought, well, maybe if he can't interbreed, maybe he took over somebody else's family. But then he's done it for at least 2 years now with babies behind him. And I know that there's a grown-up goose amongst the flock now that looks like such a cross. He's got a lot of Canada goose markings, but they just don't look all the way like a Canada goose marking. It's like when you see a tabby cat crossed with a Siamese and you've got tabby cat points.
Right.
But anyway, I just wanted to let you know that Grey Goose seems to be making himself quite at home and raising happy families at Crystal Lake.
Yeah, the two things with waterfowl, crossbreeding does happen. Mallards are the worst for it. They crossbreed with just about any duck species that there is out there. Crossbreeding between geese can happen. There's no question. There's been a lot of documentation of it. I've seen a lot of pictures of different species such as that. Another thing that geese do also is there's a surrogacy, what they call ants. And you'll have a goose that will hook up with a pair that has goslings and kind of hang around and take care of the goslings also and kind of do the protection thing as an aunt.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering if he'd done the first year, but I don't believe he's doing that.
Yeah, either way, there is a possibility. It's slim. It doesn't happen very often, but it can happen. There's no question. So both scenarios could be correct. There's no question.
Yeah, he's more aggressive than the Canada geese, and he really protects his flock.
Right.
And he doesn't like other geese near him, and he doesn't like people near him.
Yeah. Yep, that's very common.
All right. Well, okay. I just wanted to tell you what was up with that.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Other folks who have questions, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. Our guest is Larry Keller. He's the owner of Wild Birds Incorporated of Champaign. It's a store where they sell seed and feeders and birdhouses and other sorts of things for people who are interested in birds and attracted them to their yards, in watching them, in learning about them. And if you have bird questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about hummingbirds and about the fact that, I guess particularly over the last couple of years, we have seen a lot of them around here. So we're into the hummingbird migration, and they're on the way to Mexico. So it's possible that we should expect here over the next maybe a couple of weeks, really, to see goodly numbers of hummingbirds.
Correct.
What are some of the other birds that we will see who are also doing the same thing, who will be passing through here migrating?
All of your neotropicals will be migrating through. Warblers, grosbeaks, the gentleman mentioned earlier, the grosbeaks. Orioles are pretty much out of the area already. They're one of our first ones to migrate through, and they're gone. The only problem with fall migration is they're here and they're gone. You might see them, you might not. During the spring migration, when the birds are pairing up, you'll see a lot of activity at the feeders. For example, the roast-breasted grosbeaks, people have just dozens of them at a time at a feeder sometimes. During fall migration, they're still coming through the same area. They just don't stop by at the feeders. Their whole goal is to get south. And usually, you know, you've got the shortened days is causing part of the migration, plus the cold fronts coming through are pushing them. So when it pushes them through, it goes very quickly. Mm-hmm. Also, we've got hawk migration this month. We'll start seeing a lot of the larger hawk species coming through in large numbers. Also, people's occurrences with Cooper's hawks in their backyards will start picking up drastically also. Then we've got followed by waterfowl migration. We're already starting to see that with the teal migrations coming through now. And then in October, we'll start to see the big push of all the waterfowl coming through.
Okay. Is there around in sort of in the immediate area here, Champaign-Urbana, Central Illinois, are there particularly good places if you want to see migratory waterfowl?
Champaign County Forest Preserve District, any of those locations are great. Middle Fork is great. With the water situation this year, it might not be as good. Clinton Lake is an excellent place for waterfowl observation. They've got observation areas, large water. They're shallow areas of the water, so you're attracting not only the puddlers but also the divers. We'll see some of the sea ducks in that area also during the fall and winter time too.
Okay. Let's talk to somebody here at Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello. Hey, there has been some discussion about hummingbirds. I'd kind of like to push it to the other extreme. I was in Indiana yesterday and saw some bald eagles. Are there any bald eagles that kind of get in this area or...
During the winter time, especially the month of January and February, we have a large number of eagles will come down from up north, come down into this area. So it's very common to see them. There are several places in the immediate area where we're starting to get some nesting pairs. The success rate hasn't been there yet, but the pairs are they're definitely pairing up and they're starting to build the nest and to establish the territories. During the wintertime, January, February, if you get along the Illinois or Mississippi River, those are obviously your best places, and you can literally see hundreds of bald eagles in one day. If you want to do something closer, Lake Vermilion in Vermilion County, and then also Clinton Lake is another great area to see bald eagles. You're not going to see the massive numbers, but you will see them in those areas. And then another real close location, too, is the Wabash River. You'll see dozens of eagles up and down the Wabash, too.
Okay, and these are eagles that are reestablishing this area, or have there always kind of been some eagles around here? Or?
Those are eagles that are primary migratory during that time of year. Okay. We are starting to get pairs that are showing up here. There's two counties in this immediate area that have had nesting pairs in the last couple of years. And they, like I say, they have not raised any young to my knowledge, but they have established a nesting territory. So we're going to start seeing more and more as the years come along.
All right, wonderful.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. So in the past, it would have been more common in this part of the country to see eagles?
In the past, yes. Yeah, but the populations, of course, dropped off. Eagles were put on the endangered species list, now then threatened. Mm-hmm. But we've seen the numbers just explode. It's one of the best success stories as far as conservation goes in this country's history.
And are they still considered to be threatened?
They are not on the threatened list anymore, no.
Okay. Yeah, good. Next caller here is in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Quite a while ago, you and I had a discussion on the program here, and we talked very much about the area you just mentioned in passing there in the Vermilion River area, Vermilion Lake area. On the north side of Lake Vermilion is this wetlands and bird watching area that's just fabulous. It's been closed to the general public because they've put a new road in there. However, the road seems to be done, and you seem to be able to get in.
Good. Yeah, that's they got the boardwalk out there that goes into the water area out there. They've got a lot of neat educational material out along the boardwalk, and it's one of the best areas around here for birding.
Oh, definitely. The observation tower doesn't have the stairs up to it yet. However, you can still walk to the north of Newell Road up through where there's the heron rookery
up
there.
Right.
That's an amazing sight also.
Yes, definitely.
Well, that's all I wanted to say.
Yep, and that's one of the areas around here that you can possibly see the bald eagles, definitely.
Yes, they did have a nesting pair for a while, but I think the tree was blown down in a storm.
Right.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Once again, we invite questions. We'll be here for about another 15 minutes with Larry Keller from Wild Birds Incorporated. You have birding questions, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that here now we're going to see various kinds of birds migrating, pushing through here, and that there may be on this side of the migration, they may not hang around too long, not like they do in the spring, but that we are likely, among other things, to see warblers. And I know I have even seen them in past years, more in the spring, have seen them in my yard, and I've always felt like I wish that I had gotten a better look at them so I could tell what it was I was looking at.
Right.
I knew what they were generally, but they don't sit still.
Right.
Those little birds, they're small, and they move around a lot, and they won't sit still. Is there, other than perhaps trying to learn the calls, is there a good way, and maybe, you know, trying to learn the distinctive markings that you can, with a bird like that, that is a little on the shy side and won't sit still, how it is you figure out what it is you're looking at?
Fall poses a lot of different problems as far as identification, especially the fall warblers. One, their plumage is completely different mm-hmm. than what they are in the springtime. Two, their calls are not as common, so you're not hearing them as often. They're not going to feed on seed, so they're insect eaters and berry eaters, so you're not going to be able to attract them to a feeder. But this year, more so than in years in the past, simply because we have a drought situation, if you have a water source in the yard and you have some sort of movement within that water, whether it's a dripper, some sort of a little fountain pump moving some water. There's something called a water wiggler out there that's a battery-operated device that moves the water. Anything that's got that water moving signifies to birds that it's fresh water and it's going to attract them. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of the common red starts in my yard already this fall at the dripper with the bird bath. And anytime you've got that situation where we've got a drought, water is such a premium, and you think, well, there's plenty of lakes streams and everything. That is true. However, when they're moving through, especially neighborhoods, they're looking for a water source constantly, especially in these dry years. So for this year, if you have a very good water source in an area where it's very, very obvious, or very, very open area where you can observe the birds, you're going to see these type of species coming down. Then it's going to make it a little bit easier to identify.
Okay. But that sounds like an important point, that if it's just a conventional sort of bird bath, some sort of bowl that just holds the water and the water sits there.
Right.
They're not going to be as attracted to that as if they get this idea that the water's okay.
Correct. Yes. Mm, okay. Yep, exactly.
All right. Urbana next. Another caller here. Line number one.
Yes. A previous caller mentioned a prime birding site along the Vermilion with a boardwalk that just recently opened back up to the public.
Correct.
And I was wondering if you could just give a little bit more specific information about how to find that. Mm-hmm. And I'll just go ahead and get off the phone and listen on the air.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. That location is on Newell Road, and Newell Road that goes up on the north side of the lake, like the gentleman said, has been closed off for quite a few years. However, like he mentioned, it is open. You just simply drive back through there. It's going to come along over the river if you're coming from the Danville area. If you come up over the river, the bridge there, and then simply maybe a couple hundred yards down on the left-hand side is a parking lot there, and you'll see the observation tower. Get out, and there is a trail that goes back to the dock area, and it's the boardwalk that goes out into the water area there. It's a very shallow area. There's a lot of old dead trees in there. The herons are extremely prolific through there. Waterfowl is very common. Bluebirds, massive amount of bluebirds through there, especially during the fall time. You'll see a lot of them. The swallows tend to congregate there right at fall migration, which is really good this time of year. So you will see a lot of species back through there, and it's very easy to get to. It's handicap accessible, so anybody can go there.
And this is Lake Vermilion?
This is Lake Vermilion, yes.
Okay.
You can call the Vermilion County Conservation District if you want more information on that.
Okay.
Okay.
And again, other questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's say somebody who is thinking about putting up a feeder and has never had one before. What sort of general advice would you give about where to put it? And obviously, if you look at catalogs, you go someplace where they sell them. There are different kinds of feeders, maybe designed to appeal to different kinds of birds. How do you think about what it is you might want to buy?
The first thing we ask people is what type of a setup they have in their yard. If you're in a new subdivision, you have no trees. Well, then you're not going to see the bird species as such as somebody who has an established neighborhood where they've got 80-foot tall trees and pines everywhere. So what you want to do is you want to make sure you've got the habitat first to attract the birds. Once you have that established, your feeder location is key. You want to make sure, one, it's in an area where you can observe it, so you're going to be able to see the bird activity. But it also has to be near some sort of cover. Birds are more comfortable feeding at a location where they can escape from danger, whether it be on the ground or from the air, from hawks. So if you've got a tree, bushes, shrubs, anything that the birds can escape to get out of harm's way, they're going to feel more comfortable at that location. Now, as far as the feeder types go, there is, a large variety of types of feeders. So what is it that you're wanting to attract? If you're wanting to attract finches, then there are simple tube feeders that are going to feed the Niger thistle. That's one thing to do. You can go with a platform feeder on the ground that's going to get your different types of sparrow species and your juncos during the wintertime, and the doves will feed on there. Hopper feeders, the box house-shaped type feeders, those are great when they're stationary. Cardinals will use them along with your smaller birds such as your finches and chickadees. So there's a wide variety of different types. Typically what you want to do is you want to set your feeders and your feeder positions for that species. So if you know you've got woodpeckers in the area, put up a peanut feeder or a suet feeder near, say, an oak tree, any type of deciduous tree, and you want the feeder near the trunk of the tree. So it just depends on what species you want to see, where your location is. But there's just about any type of feeder available for any situation.
Mm-hmm. And there are some there are some birds that like to eat when they're on perches. So they have feeders like that that have a little thing for the bird to perch on. But then there are others that are only going to feed on the ground, so that you want to have some kind – that for them you have the platform feeder essentially.
Correct.
It's just as a flat surface that you put the food on because that's the way that they're going to want to do it, because normally they would be feeding on the ground.
Right, exactly. Yeah, platform feeders on the ground are really good. It keeps the seed area clean, so you're not going to have disease and the mold and bacteria there. Also during snow, it keeps the food off the snow and above the snow line, so you'll get a lot more bird activity.
Yeah. That's, you just touched on something that I wonder about too. If you have feeders, there's going to be on the ground underneath where the feeders are all kinds of debris.
Right.
And that is a possible breeding ground for a disease. So what should you be doing in terms of hygiene to make sure that your site is not going to cause problems?
That area should be kept clean. If it's physically getting out, raking up the shells and the debris, cleaning it up like you would be raking leaves, for example, clean it often. Also, if you're in a situation where you've got poles that can be moved or simply moving the feeders onto the other side of the tree, moving that station away from that area, let the grass grow back up, let everything settle down, and then constantly moving the station is one of the best ways to do it.
Okay. Let's talk with someone here next, someone in Watsika, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Several years, I have been successful with attracting hummingbirds using the sugar water ratio of 1 to 4 and, you know, changing that regularly.
Mm-hmm.
However, a couple months ago, I was reading in an extension curriculum for 4-H kids that you should start with a 1-to-4 ratio, but gradually increase that to 1-to-6 to prevent liver damage in the hummingbirds. Do you know anything about that or?
That I've not heard of. The liver damage that I've heard associated with the feeding of hummingbirds was from the red food coloring. That's the only thing I've heard on that. One thing that we do recommend, once you have hummingbirds feeding and feeding regularly, not necessarily during migration times, but during the regular summer period, you can weaken that solution a little bit, and simply what that's going to do is cause the hummingbird to come back more often. So you're going to see them a little more often. I have not heard that on the liver damage as far as that goes.
Okay.
Nope, that's news. I haven't heard that.
Okay. I guess maybe the Cornell lab would be able to shed more light on that issue, maybe.
Right. Yeah, we keep pretty updated on all the new feeding trends and the new information that's out there through industry publications that we receive at our office. Nothing like that has come across the line. And recently, matter of fact, there was a new company that came out with a new line of feeders, and they're still recommending the 4-to-1.
Okay. Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And one of the things that we know about hummingbirds is they like red. They like red flowers, and that's why the hummingbird feeders have red on them to attract the bird. So it's not necessary to color the syrup.
No.
As long as there's red on the feeder, that will draw them.
Yeah. And another thing, too, you want to do with the hummingbird feeders is I recommend staying away from feeders that have the yellow flowers on them. The yellow does attract the hornets and the yellow jackets during the fall. And that's what they're brought to initially to the feeding location. Then, of course, then they find that there's nectar there, and they're going to hang around. You'll have such a bad problem with the hornets that they will actually chase your hummingbirds off. So, you know, it causes a very large problem. The yellow does absolutely nothing for attracting the hummingbird. It is that red. And there are a lot of new feeders out on the market now that have only red, no yellow on them, and you'll definitely see a reduction in the number of insect problems with that particular feeder.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, too, because that's something I was wondering about as well. The hummingbirds will be attracted to the sweet stuff, but they're not the only thing that's going to be attracted to the sweet stuff.
And another feeder station that you can put up for hummingbirds, which is a little more unique, if you take a mesh bag like an onion sack, put in some rotting bananas and hang that out. It's going to attract the real small little gnats and flies, and the hummingbirds will sit there and pick them off near that bag. They won't necessarily touch the bag. They won't even go near it, but they're going to eat the insects that are attracted to it, which is kind of interesting to watch them try to catch the flying insects.
Yeah, not bad. Okay. Let's see. We have somebody here on a cell phone. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I don't mean to drive the point into the ground with the hummingbirds, but I use a commercial nectar powder that I mix with water.
Okay.
And I use the ratio, but that is the product is red.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if I need to be concerned about doing my hummingbirds harm by using that, or is that taken into account by the manufacturers?
That is, as far as we know and what we've been told in the industry, is that has been taken into account by the manufacturers. They're not going to put a product out there that's going to decrease the population of birds by any means. Okay. That product is safe.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. But again, if people wanted to do this, you do have to have the right feeder, but you don't have to buy some commercial product to feed the hummingbirds.
Right.
Again, as you said, if you just make a simple syrup, you take one part sugar, four parts water, you have to boil the water.
Right.
It has to be heated so it'll absorb the sugar, but
yes,
you will do that, and that will work just fine.
Exactly.
You don't have to do anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very easy.
We're just about down to the point here. We have to finish up. Any last thing that you'd like to mention to folks before we go?
Since we're getting into the change of the seasons here, real good time of year to get the feeders. Clean them. That's the biggest thing. We're going to have a lot of new birds coming into the area. And because we're in that transitional stage, there's going to be a few weeks here coming up, probably the next 3 weeks or so. You might lose all your birds altogether at the feeding stations. And birds are moving in and out of territories. Birds such as cardinals are not holding their territorial aggression like they normally would during the spring and summertime. So you'll start seeing more cardinals in an area. But there might be that lag time there where you're not going to have very many birds at a feeder, but it'll adjust itself.
Okay. And a couple of people have mentioned Cornell. Maybe I've just mentioned the fact that I'm sure there are lots of birding resources on the web, on the internet. But
yes,
one place where people might go is to Cornell, because it's one of the best known, Cornell University in Ithaca, one of the best known places for research on birds there is in the entire United States. They have a very lovely magazine, they have newsletters, they have all kinds of information. So if you're interested in birds, that would be one place you can go for information.
Definitely. And they're very interactive with their clients also, so they can have a lot of programs that you can be doing at home that's helping them with their research too.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Larry Keller, he's the owner of Wild Birds Incorporated, and he's located in Champaign. The program today is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Well, that's just about it for us here on Focus 584 this morning, but we want you to stay with us because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. There'll be news and sports and weather and a lot of other things. And I think, again, today in the 1 o'clock hour, we'll be running the NPR program Talk of the Nation.
That's correct, David. And today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll carry Talk of the Nation, a look at President Bush's decision to nominate John Roberts to become the next Chief Justice, and the latest on the devastation in the South in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Let's take a look now at what is happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Merc. September wheat is trading at 308.5. That's up 3.5. December, 323.75, up 3.75. September corn, 207.75, up 4.25. December corn, 221.5, up 4.25. March corn, 232.5, up 4. May corn, 238.5, up 3.5. September soybeans, 605. That up 16.5. November, 615.75, up 16.75.